pay for the work we've done. We fought in your wars in every land to keep this country free, y'all. Women, children, and men. But anytime we ask for pay or loan, that's when everything seems to turn out wrong. We've been beat up, called names, shot down and stoned. Every time we do right, somebody say we're wrong. Tell me.
Been listening to Prince performing When Will We Be Paid for the Work We've Done, originally by the Staples Singers. This is Reparations in Action, the weekly program of the African People's Solidarity Committee here on UhuruRadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution. Reparations in Action is the program of APSC, the Organization of White People Working Under the Leadership of the African People's Socialist Party, organizing in the white community for solidarity with Black power and the African liberation struggle for reparations and self-determination. And we are coming to you live today from the Uhuru House, from the Uhuru Radio studio here in St. Petersburg, Florida. This is day two also of the African People's Socialist Party's historic Cadre Development School. And we'd like to begin by appreciating and saluting the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party and Uhuru Radio for allowing the Solidarity Movement this hour on Uhuru Radio every Sunday to extend the message of Black power deep into the heart of the empire, the white oppressor nation population. Also want to give a shout out to Virginia Wilson, the Info Ed coordinator of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, as well as Jamie Simpson, who is our usual host, who is sick today. I'm filling in for Jamie. And I also want to welcome to the program today a very special guest, a wonderful comrade who is actually here for the entire month of the intensive, the Cadre Development School, from San Diego, California, Uhuru Star.
Uhuru, Uhuru. Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you on the show today. And the topic that was announced for today's show was there is no such thing as workers in general, socialism through reparations. And we will be talking about that. And that was inspired by a discussion that Chairman Amalia Shetela and APSC Chairwoman Penny Hess had on Africa Live last week about an incident that took place in South Africa where an African student refused to tip a white waitress until, as he wrote on her receipt, she gives the land back, or until white people give the land back. So that sparked a lot of outrage from white people. I think they actually gave that white woman $30,000 because she cried. So we do want to have a discussion about what that's about and how we as white people in APSC understand the question of white people and white workers in South Africa and also here and anywhere else. But before we do that, Star, so you're here for the Cadre Development School.
That's right.
So how has it been so far? I know we're just getting started, but if you could just tell our listeners a little bit about what you've experienced the last day or so.
Oh, it's been absolutely amazing. Just the flag raising alone tells me that I'm in the right place, that I'm on the right side of history. It took a lot to get here, and just arriving at the Uhuru House tells me that the African Revolution is happening and that we've got a principled role to play in that. Uhuru.
Uhuru. Could you say more about the flag raising?
Yeah, so you know, all of us here that are here doing our physical and political training for this month-long Cadre Development School, we came from all over the world, and before anything started, it was really important to raise the African flag, the red, black, and green, and which is the symbol of African liberation, going all the way back to Marcus Garvey. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we moved in cadence, we moved in rhythm, in uniform movements that reveals the way that we're willing to work together to do whatever it takes to get African self-determination and to help build, you know, an independent African economy. So we all marched outside, and all the groups stood in solidarity and in total black power and raised the flag and, you know, started off this month-long intensive that's part of a really historic time. You know, things are changing very quickly politically all over the world, and we're in the right place. So it was beautiful. And then, you know, all the physical and political training that's going to happen this month to become cadre, to become steeled cadre, and, to commit ourselves to ending white colonial terror.
I'm glad you brought that up about the flag, because, tomorrow is the quote unquote 4th of July Independence Day, and we're going to be seeing a lot of red, white, and blue flags all over the place. Banks are going to be closed, right? Banks are closed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is a quote unquote national holiday that is like all of the other American and European holidays, a celebration of genocide and bloodshed, and colonialism and slavery, and in this case, independence for one group of white slave masters from another. But it reminds me of growing up and going to school, and the fact that you are required, or at least you were when I was in elementary school and high school, to start off every day with the Pledge of Allegiance to the American flag. And I actually had friends and myself got in trouble for not doing that.
Yep.
And that Pledge of Allegiance, you know, everyone is expected to get up and say the Pledge of Allegiance, including Africans. And it's basically a pledge of allegiance to oppression.
That's right.
And, you know, for white people, it's a pledge of allegiance to remain complicit with America's oppression of African people. And for African people, it's a pledge of allegiance to not resist, you know, a pledge of allegiance to just go along with the status quo and accept the verdict of imperialism, as the chairman says. And, you know, at the Uhuru House, when they raise the red, black, and green flag, which is the polar opposite, you know, it's a flag that represents liberation. We all salute and pledge the flag, including white people, you know, and we do that because we are pledging our allegiance to reparations and to the African nation. So, I'm glad you brought that up. And it was very powerful, and it was sort of done in military formation. And I'm looking forward to seeing how that develops. So you're here from San Diego. What was it that, why did you come basically for the intensive, to spend a month here with everything going on, work, et cetera, family? What was it that brought you here to St. Petersburg, Florida for this development school?
Well, I can answer that in two words, and it's called African internationalism. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's this perfect system that Chairman Omali Eshetela of the African People's Socialist Party has laid out, this perfect science and approach to liberation that I had never seen before in years of college studies, college teaching, reading every book under the sun, joining this movement and that movement, which was really sort of to stroke my own ego, my own white left ego, and still go home to my safe neighborhood where I wasn't worried about, you know, police brutality and the school to prison pipeline for my own child. So it just made perfect sense to come here for this month-long training and really improve my skills as, you know, as cadre, as a member of the African People's Solidarity Committee, which works directly under the leadership of the party. And I just can't imagine being anywhere else. I cannot imagine right now being at the house, you know, like buying fireworks and preparing the food to celebrate white colonial terror. That's backwards to me, man.
Yeah. And so you're here, and Comrade Jackson is also here from San Diego. And then there's Maureen, who's here from Oakland, and Johan here in St. Pete that's participating.
And from Minneapolis as well, we've got Comrade Lisa Watson.
Who else? We got Kitty Riley, Janice Kant, also here from St. Pete, and Sandy Thompson, or Sandra Forrest. So it's a good group, and we really are honored to participate in this intensive, which is, there's five units at this intensive, and we are the Che unit. and the other units are African People's Socialist Party units. And, you know, we're going to be doing a lot of organizing. All of the units are going to be doing a lot of organizing this upcoming month, going into different precincts in St. Petersburg and like really saturating all of these precincts with literature about the party's campaigns, especially the campaign for the justice for the three drowned girls who were murdered by the Pinellas County Sheriff's Department. And the mother of one of those girls, Yashika Clemens, is also participating in this intensive. So very, very powerful. And yeah, so to get to our topic of discussion today, white workers. What's the first thing that comes to your mind when you hear that phrase, Star?
The Wobblies and the union movement and...
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's interesting that when you hear the term workers from the mouth of a white organization or a white socialist, it's always sort of understood that they're talking about white workers, because the conditions are so different for white workers and African workers that... I mean, the other day I did a Google image search for African working class, and most of what comes up is the Uhuru movement, because nobody else even talks about the African working class. It's like it doesn't exist as a social force in the analysis of most other, you know, organizations. Certainly everyone on the white left like can't even see the African, or refuses to see the African working class. So we wanted to do this, talk about this, because as I mentioned, we have some good stuff here I'd like to read to you, Star, and to our listeners. So this African man, his name was Ntokozo Kwabe. He's an Oxford student on the Rhodes Scholarship, which he's done a lot of work actually around protesting the presence of Cecil Rhodes statues on universities in South Africa. And he is actually one of the leaders of that movement, the Rhodes Must Fall movement, which demanded the removal of the statues of Rhodes from universities and public spaces. And Cecil Rhodes is the one of the people who actually, he was the one who used the phrase, we must become imperialists, when walking throughout the impoverished working class communities of England. He saw that, he heard the English workers crying out for bread, and he said, for the poor of England to have bread, we must become imperialists. So that tells you everything you need to know right there. And so he personally oversaw the colonization of South Africa, or what African people call Azania, and under the British Empire, and slaughtered thousands of Africans throughout the continent. And he was actually infamous for using the British Maxim machine gun and slaughtering thousands of Africans in a single afternoon and then sitting down for tea. Mm. There's a famous account of them doing that. And Rhodesia, which was the name of Zimbabwe up until Zimbabwe achieved formal independence, was named for Cecil Rhodes. So he is the one who, he is a great, you know, perfect emblem of the whole white worker colonial question. And when this African man refused to tip this white waitress, he was really demonized in the media, and it became a huge thing. It went viral, actually. And like I said, white people threw, I think, $30,000 towards the teary-eyed white woman. And people looked in. One of our researchers for the show looked into this person, Ntozoko Kwabe, and found that he had actually made some very, very powerful statements in the past as well that kind of give you an indication of who he is. Apparently, when in the aftermath of the what happened in France, the Paris-France attacks a little while ago, he said, quote, "You can miss me with the buffoonery of changing Facebook profile pictures to violent imperial flags and hashtagging prayers for Paris. I will silently pretend to, but not kneel to carry out. I refuse to be cornered by white supremacist hashtagism into believing that showing my disgust for the loss of lives in France mandates identifying with a state that has for years terrorized and continues to terrorize innocent lives in the name of imperialism, colonialism, and other violent barbarities. So this is
Uhuru.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
He says, I do not stand with France, not while it continues to terrorize and bomb Africa and the Middle East for its imperial interests. We will not end terrorism by choosing the terrorist by our subjective sensibilities and popular propaganda normalize. Okay, so, and then in another Facebook post, he talked about, you know, Cecil Rhodes and explained further why he was part of that campaign to tear down the statue of Cecil Rhodes. So this is the context in which, you know, this man sat in a restaurant. And you have to understand also that South Africa, you know, in the U.S. we hear about Nelson Mandela and, you know, the end of apartheid and this idea that South Africa has finally reached the promised land. But, you know, back in the 90s, Chairman Amalia Chatel, and before that, the chairman was actually booed. Not off stage. I don't think he would get off the stage, but he was booed for exposing Nelson Mandela as a neo-colonial puppet of white power imperial interests. And now a lot of people can see what Mandela was really about because, you know, two decades after the end of apartheid, nothing has changed in South Africa. In fact, things are worse.
Things are much worse.
Yes. So I think the statistic is that 80% of the land in South Africa is still controlled by white people, by white business interests and white power. So, and you know, the majority of the people there live in horrific poverty and shanty towns and things like that. So it was in this context that he delivered that note saying, we will tip you when you return the land. And a lot of the one of the things that happened was Gazi Kodzo of the African People's Socialist Party made a video where he basically said that Africans shouldn't tip white workers, and he called out the fact that even a white worker sits on the pedestal of the oppression of African workers, and that there's not some kind of natural alliance between white workers and African workers. And that sparked a lot of debate, a lot of anger from white leftists.
Including socialists.
Who said that he was uniting with the class exploiter of both black workers and white workers by criticizing this white worker.
What does that mean?
So it started a very interesting discussion. And that's some of what we wanted to talk about today. And I have a quote here to give this some context. Here is a quote from Chairman Amalia Chatel. He says, capitalism was born in disrepute, born of the rapes, massacres, occupations, genocides, colonialism, and every despicable act humans are capable of inflicting. Capitalism was not responsible for some great, otherwise unimaginable leap in production, which despite its contradictions, resulted in human progress and enlightenment. What capitalism did was to rip the vast majority of humanity out of the productive process in Africa, Asia, the Middle East, Australia, and what has come to be known as the Americas. The hundreds of millions dead due to the slave trade and slavery itself. The millions exterminated everywhere. Europeans ventured. These are people whose hands were forever removed from a relationship with nature that would result in production. Europeans achieved their national identity by way of this bloody process. This is not something that only happened a long time ago. The world's peoples are suffering the consequences of capitalism's emergence right now. Locked in colonies and the indirect rule of neo-colonialism, restricted to lives characterized by brutality, ignorance, and violence in the barrios of the Americas, in other internal colonies characterized as Indian reservations and black ghettos, kept under the nuclear-backed, armed-to-the-teeth watch of military forces born of a state power that has its origins in protecting the relationship between capitalism and its imperial pedestal. Capitalism has been the absolute factor in restricting production and development. It has concentrated productive capacity in the hands of the world's minority European population that sits atop the pedestal of our oppressive reality. capitalism was not the good progressive force that is the precursor to something better for humanity. Capitalism was a disaster that rescued Europe from a diseased, feudal existence at the expense of the world. Chairman Amalia Shetella from An Uneasy Equilibrium. And it appears that we have a caller on the line. Uhuru, caller, could you identify yourself?
Hi, this is Karen Alexander again. Are you there?
Yes, Uhuru, thank you for calling in.
Hey, is the mother Shamika still on the line?
No, she's not. Now, this is a new show, Reparations in Action.
Ah, okay. Right. Never mind.
Thank you.
Bye.
One thing about that quote that I have to really honor the chairman's words around this, and it puts the whole situation with this white waitress and the indignation that she felt and other whites came in on with her, and you know, donating what, $30,000 to her for her so-called cause or something.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I think what happens sometimes is that, you know, folks, like part of the quote was about how this isn't just something that's happened in the past.
Right.
And I suffered from this for a long time as a worker who's white, and just looking at what was in my bank account and how much I had earned and my earning capabilities and all that, and without a true understanding that African internationalism gives us about the pedestal that we sit on, this pedestal that allowed me to saunter in and get that job with just a quick little interview, and oh, here it is.
Mm-hmm.
And black and brown friends struggling to survive in a system that glorifies whiteness, that rewards it, and you know, the interest from slavery and genocide and colonialism that just keeps churning through our own economies. And so, you know, It was such a powerful resistance for this man in South Africa to say, no, enough already.
Mm-hmm.
And it speaks to so many different levels of economic power and wealth. Here in the U.S., you know, whites make 22 times more than Africans. And, you know, just for that little act of resistance, it seems like a bigger part of this wave of resistance that's going to completely destroy that pedestal of parasitic capitalism.
Uhuru. If anyone is listening in and would like to call, please do partake in this discussion. You can call 727-565-1599. If you're in the UK, you can call 020-8133-6629. And if you're on Skype, our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, U-H-U-R-U-R-A-D-I-O. You're listening to Reparations in Action. On that last point that you made, Comrade Starr, you know, I think it's... One important point that Chairman Amalia Shetella makes is that it's questionable to even refer to such an entity as the, quote, white working class.
Mm.
And this is an understanding that the chairman really developed over the years because, you know, on the show last week, Chairwoman Penny Hess mentioned that, you know, there was child labor in England and in other places in Europe. And, you know, at the beginning of capitalism, when capitalism first started to develop, before it had truly consolidated itself and stolen more and more loot so it could build itself up, that there was actually child labor and all the things that you associate with, like, the horrors of capitalism around the world were happening, you know, here. And the chairman pointed out that child labor represented progress for white people. Because before that, that was at the onset of capitalism. But before that, there wasn't capitalism in Europe, there was feudalism. And feudalism was a situation where the vast majority of the people in Europe were poor, were extremely poor, and were tied to the land. And the land was owned by the nobility. So the nobility basically was the only social force that had any wealth. And there was no real viable economy in Europe because you had things like the plague that would come through and wipe out like almost half the population in 4 years. And as the chairman says, you can't have a viable economy if half your population gets wiped out
mm-hmm.
in 4 years. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. So it was through attacking Africa, enslaving African people, and committing genocide against the indigenous people of this land, and creating the pedestal upon which capitalism rests, that white workers were born. And as the chairman says, like the white working class and the white ruling class are historical twins, which means they were born at the same time from the same womb, which is parasitism, parasitic colonial theft of Africa's resources. It gave birth to both the bourgeoisie and the so-called white working class. So, you know, it's a really profound thing, the opportunism of the white working class historically. And it's not a benign thing. It's not that, well, white workers have just sort of casually benefited from what the white ruling class is doing. The white workers have in many cases been the vanguard of white terrorism against African people. When the white power state was less consolidated, it was the white workers that put hoods on and robes, you know, or even in the dead of night or even during the day, you know, in mass numbers, like here in St. Petersburg, you know, in 1914, when thousands of white people, 1,500 white people gathered and lynched John Evans, you know, that happened all over the country. And it wasn't Rockefeller doing that. You know, it was ordinary working class white people. And then when Africans, you know, left the South and started to look for work in the unions, it was white workers, including Irish white workers, that stepped on the backs of African people in order to get a piece of the pie for themselves. So it's a very profound history of white opportunism. And the response to it is not, as the white left says, to have some kind of unprincipled multiracial or multinational workers unity, like a we are the world kind of workers of the world unite, black and white unite and fight kind of stuff that you hear from the white left. That it's just like, oh well, hey, we're white workers, we've been lynching you for hundreds of years, we benefit from your oppression, our conditions are totally different from yours. I own a boat, you know, I'm a white worker and I own a boat. I don't actually own a boat, but in character here. And hey, but by the way, you want to unite and overthrow capitalism? Like, it makes no sense. That's not the, like, so the role of white workers is the same as what we say the role of all white people is, which is reparations. White workers owe reparations.
That's
to
right.
African people. And the way that a white worker, who, yes, you do get exploited by capitalism, you know, you do work hard and you don't actually see the value of what you do. But the way that you can kill the capitalist and end the system of oppression that even you face is through solidarity with African workers.
Right, and making reparations. That's right, which is making actual material reparations, not painting a sign that says fight for 15 or something and going out and fighting for the minimum wage, which can indirectly, you know, benefit black and brown workers. But there isn't that kind of, you know, the deeper understanding that we're getting here this month in the Cadre Development School is, you know, reminds us about, you know, if I'm, you know, if I'm a white worker and I'm protesting a, say, a $10 or $11 minimum wage, man, do I have it backwards in terms of, you know, the social status and the economic power of colonized peoples all over the world. I mean, there's women right now hauling water, two buckets of water, 6 miles to bathe their children and to cook and to drink. And, you know, I'm going to grapple with, I'm going to, you know, be mad and be incensed and be offended by, you know, $12 an hour. Most of the world lives on about $1 or $2 a day, which is like a quarter of the, you know, iced grande latte you just bought. You know, we've got to keep it in perspective. And that's what the Uhuru movement does for us.
Uhuru. I agree. And I want to just bring to this discussion a few statistics that we have here because, you know, white people, we really like statistics and facts and documentation, especially when it comes to exposing us. You know, it's like we don't believe it unless we see all the numbers and everything. So we prepared that for anyone who might doubt what we're talking about here, because it's one thing to say that white workers don't experience the same conditions as African workers. But without the statistics, you know, a white worker might think about all the stuff they deal with in their life and be like, well, screw you, I deal with a lot of pain. Well, it's not about your subjective individual experience. Let's look at the facts. So located in central Illinois, Peoria, is that how you pronounce that? Peoria is one of the poorest cities in the country. The poverty rate for the black population is 28.2%. The poverty rate for the white population is a third of that. In the same city, in one of the poorest cities in the country, the median annual income for white households is $58,000, double the annual income of a typical African household. This brings me to another point that Chairman O'Malley – well, actually, before I get to that. Okay, while Africans are about five times more likely to be incarcerated than their white counterparts in Illinois, they are more than eight times more likely to be incarcerated than whites. As in the case of many other U.S. cities, the incarceration rate is likely far higher in areas such as Peoria. So so the question of the state, I think, is also really important, which the prison issue brings that into the discussion, because we have to be clear about this issue. And as the chairman has explained, that the colonial the class question is concentrated in the colonial question. And one way of looking at that is, like, if there's a white worker and an African worker, and they're working in a factory on an assembly line, and they're getting paid the same amount, and they have the same boss, they're still not experiencing the same relationship to the state.
That's right.
Because the white worker, even though he's making the same wage, et cetera, and he's working in the same setting, is not colonized. And when they leave that building, when they leave that factory, they leave into two different worlds. And that's just the nature of colonialism.
That's right. The state apparatus is set up to protect them on their way home, to exactly. protect their kids in school, not to drag their children out of desks at school and begin criminalizing them at 5 years old in kindergarten for typical, childlike behavior. So the state, serves to protect white workers and just keeps reinforcing colonial terror on black workers, African workers throughout the United States. So, the notion that white workers and African workers in the U.S. making the same wage are equal is not only wrong, not only mythology, mm-hmm. but it's actually, it's immoral to think of it that way, to think that all things in the past are erased, mm-hmm. that, it's a level playing field. And I always think of this analogy that was taught to me by one of my best professors in undergraduate school. It was an African professor, drew on the board a track with the staggered lanes for a one lap sprint. The lanes have to be staggered because the runner on the outside would have further to run. And, there's this perception that the lanes are staggered, that everything's equal, that legislation, like civil rights legislation, was the great equalizer, and it just is not the case. That's not the reality in the U.S.
Oh, for real. Yeah, I mean, I think also when we talk about white workers, a quote that, I would bring into this discussion as well, which the chairman often quotes this, is from Marx, who made a lot of errors, was wrong about a lot of things, couldn't see a lot of things, but occasionally would make statements that were so accurate that it seemed like even Marx didn't understand how accurate they were. For example, he said that veiled slavery or wage labor in Europe required as its pedestal slavery pure and simple in the New World. Not, I mean, when in the New World, he meant in the Americas, mm-hmm. and Africa. So that quote, which is buried in the last few chapters of Das Kapital and is basically a footnote, in Marxism, is like the fundamentals of African internationalism, mm-hmm. to understand that even the exploitation of the white worker, the wage exploitation of the white worker, happens on the pedestal of the colonial enslavement and oppression of all African people. All African people, which I think is another point that's important to make, is that the entire African nation is oppressed. And the heart of it is the African working class. But even if you're an African professor or an African insurance salesman, like Arthur McDuffie in Miami in the 1980s, riding his motorcycle home from work, and being chased down by the police and getting his, you know, his head, his skull cracked open. The relationship to the state is a colonial relationship. So reparations is the only solution. And white people, all white people owe reparations, including the white workers. And it is through reparations and solidarity with African liberation that, that white people in general, and including white workers, can actually fight against the capitalist ruling class, against our own ruling class, and end our complicity with it, which historically, what white people have called class struggle has just been a competition with the bourgeoisie for control of the world, for control of the stolen loot and labor of African and indigenous people. And reparations is a way to finally end that, that legacy, and start a new one. So we will be right back here on Reparations in Action, here with Comrade Star from San Diego. This is Jesse Neville on UhuruRadio.com. And we have a song here by Joe Carter called Please, Mr. Foreman. And this song, I selected this because it's used in a documentary called I Do Mind Dying, which is, I'm sorry, the documentary is actually called Finally Got the News. And there's a book about the same topic called I Do Mind Dying. And it's about the Detroit Revolutionary Union Movement, DRUM, that was an African workers' movement in the 60s in Detroit, in the auto industry. And it's a very powerful documentary. We actually watched it 2 years ago at the last Cadre Intensive. So it shows you the struggle of African workers that was rising up in the 60s in this country. So we will be back shortly. This is Joe Carter's Please, Mr. Foreman. Welcome back to Reparations in Action here on UhuruRadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution. This is Jesse. I'm here with Comrade Star from San Diego, California, who is here for the historic 2016 Cadre Development School that the African People's Socialist Party is holding in this city this July. So we are discussing the issue of white workers, the history of the opportunism and colonial complicity and violence of the white workers against African workers and African people in general, and the way forward. As the chairman has said, the road to socialism is painted black. So white people who are interested in seeing an end to capitalism, who are interested in seeing an end to imperialism, have to find our way into the African Revolution through joining APSC and our mass organization, the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, not through following Bernie Sanders, who proclaims to be a champion of the work. I'm sorry, the middle class. I don't think I've ever heard him say working class. Or before that, things like the Occupy movement and other, you know, things that represent the white left. I mean, there's many different manifestations. Some are more sophisticated than others, but it's all pretty much the same thing. It's all pretty much about maintaining our place on the pedestal of colonialism and national oppression of African people. So we wanted to talk about that. In light of this discussion, Comrade Starr, are we the 99%?
No, we're not the 99%.
Thank you for clearing that up. And why is that?
Well, I've got to start with, I just Googled the Occupy movement, and here's the definition that Google tells us about the Occupy movement, which, by the way, I participated in. What's it been, 4 years or so? Mm-hmm. And you know, it was in the midst of the so-called Arab Spring and right. all kinds of brilliant, you know, colonial subjects, resistance to colonial terror. And so here comes the Occupy movement. White kids all over the country camping out in parks downtown. Mm-hmm. The Occupy movement, according to Google, is the international branch of the Occupy Wall Street movement that protests against social and economic inequality around the world. Its primary goal being to make the economic and political relations in all societies less vertically hierarchical and more flatly distributed, which is part of the reason in the Occupy movement, nothing got done. There would be, you know, kids camped out for weeks and weeks and weeks and, you know, felt empowered because they started from this place of this false sense of disempowerment right. that, oh, we're so exploited as workers, and I broke my nail and wanted to go home, and my boss said I couldn't go home, and, you know, just this lack of sympathy with colonized workers all over the world. And it was on a consensus model. And so mic check every 20 minutes about, you know, to try to make a decision about where to forage for food, or, you know, whether we were going to set up a library of books and if we could include anarchist books and stuff. And it was just a big camp out mm-hmm. that made, you know, white workers, young, predominantly young white workers, but it also brought out a lot of the sort of retired hippies from the 60s and the folks that yes. were the opportunists from the civil rights movement back when. Yep. And so there's this weird combination of folks out there and who accomplished very little except for sort of making the news. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they brought out their Guy Fawkes masks and Guy Fawkes, you know, sort of became, and V for Vendetta had just come out a couple years before that. So it was a real popular film and sort of became the symbol for this. And in Occupy San Diego, we'd been there for 2 weeks and the pigs were trying to get rid of us. And, you know, we were trying to resist. And meanwhile, you know, black and brown workers were on the bus line going right past us every day to their second and third jobs to try and put food on the table. Where did we find the time to be out there, you know, camping out, sleeping? In fact, I must, in full transparency, I tried one night to stay out there, and by 2 a.m, I was too cold. I drove home. You know, it just shows the position that we occupied and the arrogance to think that we were the workers with the worst problems in the world.
Well, while we're going down the Occupy memory lane here, I mean, first of all, I want to unite with what you said, that this was essentially a movement born out of the discontent that many white people, especially young white people, my generation, who are experiencing the fact that capitalism is falling apart. and the future that was expected and guaranteed by my parent to my parents' generation is not expected and guaranteed to my generation. So many white people, young white people, have flocked to things like the Occupy movement, and now the Bernie Sanders is kind of the electoral expression of the same phenomenon. You know, he's kind of the Occupy candidate. Because it's a response, it's an expression of discontent with capitalism, but it's an expression of discontent with capitalism that translates to, why don't I get to benefit from capitalism to the same extent my parents did? It's not a discontent with capitalism that's like, this social system is born out of oppression and colonialism and slavery, and I don't want to benefit from the oppression of the rest of humanity. And
which is what the Uhuru Solidarity Movement offers.
Exactly. And that even recognizing that there's no future, to say like, oh, well, I don't have the guarantee of like the white picket fence house and the job and the 401k and all that stuff, and I'm racked with student loan debt. These things are actually true of me. So I am part of that demographic. I understand it. But my response to it, because of I'm under the leadership of the party, my response to it is to understand that, yeah, that there's no future in capitalism. There's no future. There's no, as the chairman says, there's no putting the genie back in the bottle. It's never going back to the good old days. And actually, I'm happy about that, because the good old days meant that the noose was tighter around the necks of the oppressed and colonized peoples of the world, and the chains were tighter. And now Africans and Arabs and indigenous people are breaking those chains and tying that noose off. And that's making things very unstable and insecure for the white population. And to understand, which we can only understand through being under the leadership of the African Revolution, that that is a dying imperialism. It's not a future. It's not a future that we can expect. And it's frankly not a future we should even want. And that our only future is to break our ties with that system altogether and align ourselves with the oppressed peoples that are making that system go into crisis in the first place. Through their resistance. So anyway, I just wanted to unite with that. And, you know, at the time of the Occupy movement, you know, we did participate in it, but not, we didn't go there and just say we are the 99%. We went there to influence it, because we're like, this is good. White people, I mean, the chairman had said that APSC should have been out there during the Tea Party. Anytime there's white people that are out there pissed off, you know, the Solidarity Movement should be out there directing that in the direction of the African Revolution and reparations. So, I mean, if we would consider that, why wouldn't we consider going to the Occupy movement? So we were out there, and you know, we were in New York. We went to the Occupy movement in New York, and there's actually a kind of famous picture of one of the members holding a sign that said, the 99% lives at the expense of, or white people live at the expense of the real 99%, something like that. And that kind of went viral. And we were building the Day in Solidarity with African People campaign, some of our organizers, when we were out there. And then here in St. Pete, I think our participation like made Occupy St. Pete dissolve, because we went there and we didn't go as USM. We went, I mean, we did, but we went and we were like, hey, we're here, we're Occupy St. Pete. And because no one speaks for Occupy. Right. So everyone does, you know, and we would get up on the mic and we would talk about Wall Street owes reparations to African people. White people owe reparations. If we hate capitalism, we have to be for reparations. And that simple idea like infuriated the actual leaders of Occupy St. Pete, because there were always anyone who's saying there's no leader is the leader. So but we did win certain things from that, and we did win members, and it was good to be out there influencing it. But actually, okay, this is a little rambling, but you reminded me when you were talking about being out there and you saw African workers coming by on the buses. In Miami, which I visited the Occupy encampment there, because that's where I'm from. I went there once. And what happened to the Occupy in Miami was that a group of white occupiers decided to move into the African community in Liberty City. And really, really weird story, but this guy who was somehow connected to like Colombian imperial, like neocolonial drug cartels or something, like he owned a building in Miami in the black community as a white guy, and he decided to basically open it up for white for the Occupy movement to use it, to occupy it. And so these all these white kids came in and occupied this house in the middle of the impoverished African community. And they called it Occupy the Hood.
Oh, no, they didn't.
And the Africans in the community actually resisted it and said, like, can you get these people out of here?
Yeah.
Like, the cops kept getting called. They were doing drugs. You know, they were playing loud music. They were drawing in the state.
Yeah.
Which is so typical.
Which and it sounds like it's based on the charity model.
Yeah.
That,
exactly.
Yeah. That happens among white leftists, that as long as I donate, you know, to maybe an African orphanage or something like that once a month, I've done my part. But the whole idea is to return material resources. And, you know, there was indigenous resistance to very white, lily white Occupy movement in San Diego. The Zapatista student organization came over and said, what's this about? And folks said, it's about occupying this space in order to get our rights and, you know. And they said, okay, so this is Kumeyaay land. This is native indigenous land. Mm-hmm. And you guys are emulating occupiers? You're emulating occupation? Mm-hmm. Can we talk for a minute about the Israeli occupation of Palestine?
Yes.
Can we talk about the Spanish and American occupation of the Philippines and of Mexico? You know, the French and Vietnam and Algeria, they just broke it down.
Yeah.
And to some occupiers' credit, they packed up and left. They saw it. They made the connection. And that was long before I had learned African internationalism. Mm-hmm. Little light bulbs were trying to light up in my head.
Yes.
That would bring me ultimately to this movement. But it wasn't until the African resistance in Ferguson that I really got the memo about why I need to be here in Uhuru solidarity.
Uhuru. Right. Yeah, I mean, what we are trying to do is build a mass movement of white people for reparations to African people, so that the next time there's hundreds of thousands of white people storming Wall Street, it's not chanting, we are the 99%, or demanding our student loan money back. It's demanding reparations from Wall Street to Black Star Industries, to the African independent economy, and to the struggle of African people for their total emancipation from colonialism. And that is our goal. And we do want to build a movement, a white reparations to African people movement. And, you know, it sounds sort of weird to people at first when they try to think about that. Like, try to imagine. Like, we've seen mass movements of white people in this country. The Bernie Sanders thing, even the Trump thing. Those are like mass movements of white people. The Occupy movement was a mass white people's movement. And what we're talking about is building a mass white people's movement for reparations to African people and in solidarity with Black Power under the leadership of the African working class. We want to build days in solidarity with African people and marches against genocide. I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about that, Star.
Sure.
Star is the political action chair of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, and will be leading up a process to hold a march against genocide in San Diego. And we do want to spread this throughout the country so that throughout October, we can build these marches in the white community for reparations to African people and to charge the U.S. with genocide against African people.
Yeah, marches against genocide and rallies for reparations, not just to get out there and to hear ourselves shout, but to actually return the material resources that we've stolen historically. So throughout the month of October, I'm really excited about this. This is part of the parties, the African People's Socialist Party's Africans 1 Billion Strong campaign. And the slogan from the party on that is, it's our money and we want it now.
Right.
Like, enough of this talk. Great, you guys camped out for a couple weeks. Where's our material resources, you know?
Right.
And it always speaks to one of the points on the party's 14-point you know, platform about the party's demands. And if you haven't ever seen that, go to theburningspear.com and look up the party's 14-point platform. The one about illegal taxation without representation. There's so many different levels of you know, domination of resources, control of resources by white power all over the world. And so these marches and rallies are going to be designed not only to continue building this mass movement. You guys were getting more members every day. I think we've gotten like four or five new members within the last couple days. And it's really incredible. You know, white people want to hear this message. They, you know, they want to have an avenue where, you know, I think there's this feeling amongst folks that, you know, what can I do? And you know, somehow putting a sign in the back of your car and going and marching and shouting is good, yes, to control the narrative. But we really have a deep moral responsibility to return what was stolen. It's a basic concept. It's the golden rule. So, yeah, the campaigns Watch for the Days in Solidarity with African People in October. The Uhuru Solidarity Movement will be bringing marches and rallies to cities throughout the country, including on October 15th. The weekend of October 15th, when the chairman Omali Ashitela himself and chairwoman Penny Hess of the African People Solidarity Committee will ideally be coming to San Diego. We're working hard to bring them there, and you can work hard to bring them to your city as well. We've got reparations challenges, all kinds of ways. If you are the working poor, or you know, are struggling to make ends meet, you know, I'm just a simple teacher. Last summer, I gave surfing lessons, and I raised $300 towards my reparations pledge, and it's the right thing to do. It's the right side of history. Uhuru.
Uhuru. Thank you so much, Star, for being on the show.
Uhuru, thanks for having me.
I think it was a great discussion, and we are really looking forward to the next three shows that we're going to be having, because we have Star here, and we have other comrades here who will be participating in the Reparations in Action show. Before we close out, I would like to make a few announcements. Today, tune in to burningspear.com on Facebook, on the burningspear.com website, on YouTube, Burning Spear TV, to watch What is a Cadre? Sunday rally, going to be broadcast 4 p.m. Eastern time today. We also want to announce that we are holding events throughout the country to build support for the Three Drowned Black Girls campaign, including in Seattle, Wednesday, July 6th, 7 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time at The Station, 2566 16th Avenue South, an event on Black community control of the police. In Gainesville, Florida, Justice for the Three Drowned Black Girls open meeting Sunday, July 10th, 2 to 4 p.m. at Alachua County Library Headquarters, Foundation Room 401E, 401 East University Ave, Gainesville, Florida. And we encourage every white person out there to join the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. Take the Pledge of Solidarity with African People. Take the Reparations Challenge and become a member of this growing organization, the only organization of white people on the planet that works under the leadership of the Black Revolution and fights for white reparations to African people. So thank you all. And you can do that at uhurusolidarity.org/join-USM. So we deeply appreciate Uhuru Radio, the African People's Socialist Party, and all of you for tuning in today. And we are going to close out with hearing the second half of When Will We Be Paid by Prince. Uhuru.
Uhuru.
We pick cotton and lay the railroads near. Worked our marines down to the bone. And your love of mail. My country, 'tis of thee. Will we ever sing out loud, land of liberty?